Accession number 14610, Reel 1.
Captain Fort Johnston, Reel 1. Captain Richard Fort Johnston, Reel 1, being interviewed by Duncan Anderson, Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, 7th of April, 1994. Well, first of all, Richard, thank you very much for being willing to come along this afternoon and be interviewed. We've only got a very short time, and I should explain to those who will be listening in perhaps 50 years' time or so, that this is the end of a junior staff and command course, which has been very grueling for both of us. What I'd like to ask you first is details about what your position was in the Cheshire Regiment before you went to Bosnia.
I was the regimental signals officer. We were an armoured infantry battalion, recently converted, serving in Fallingbostel. And so I had done 6 months from being posted back into the regiment, during which time I had been an untrained regimental signals officer. Mm-hmm. I was just about to go on my RSO's course at the School of Infantry in Warminster when the news of our deployment broke out, and it was debatable for a time whether I was going to go on that course. But it was then felt that it was all very well as a peacetime battalion in training to be an untrained RSO, and so this commanding officer decided that risking my missing the first bit of the tour, he would send me to Warminster to continue as planned on the course, and that's what I did, and then rejoined the battalion, and as luck would have it, they'd only just deployed anyway, so I didn't miss anything really, apart from the training, most of which I missed.
Right, and so the actual circumstances in which you flew down to Bosnia, I mean, you must have been apprehensive and excited about the prospects of the Cheshires actually going off to Bosnia.
I had very mixed feelings, partly due to the fear of the unknown. My interest had been excited very much by the news coverage up until then, and seeing the advance and recce parties of my own battalion going, seeing friends on the television daily, not just senior officers, but my own colleagues and peer group as liaison officers going about their route recces with their little teams in quite dangerous circumstances sometimes. And so that excited me, and I was looking forward to that. I was very nervous as a newly trained regimental signals officer, and that had made me realise what I hadn't known before, and therefore how much I would have to know going out there to basically establish the full communications plan for an entire battalion group with an emphasis on rearward communications to a base in Split, a couple of hundred miles over very hilly country, poor communications country. And they were also exacerbated by my mixed feelings by a difficult relationship which had started in Germany with a girlfriend who was a nurse, and it became very difficult because I was sent away for 10 weeks before the deployment, and then I was trying to resolve problems before I went away to Bosnia. So that, just a bit of human side of it, if you like, didn't help my state of mind. But overall, I was very positive and looking forward to it. I know that most of the people on my course were absolutely furiously jealous of the fact that I was going to be an RSO putting my newly found knowledge straight into action.
What was the morale of the Cheshires like at the time? Because as I recall, the Cheshires were due for amalgamation, and so this was really going to be the last time the Cheshires, the old 22nd foot, had actually gone off on operations in 300 years. It looked like this was going to be the end of the Cheshires.
Yes. That didn't play much of a part because we'd been under threat of amalgamation for so long by then, over a year, that although it was still in our minds, we'd actually put that aside and set it to rest by deciding it was an order which we had to comply with, and therefore we decided on what the regiment was going to be called, the new regiment. It was going to be a new start, there was going to be no infighting, and all the various dress and accoutrements and all the sort of very minor stuff had been sorted out. So really we'd put that behind us in many ways. But yes, there was a feeling that this was a last fling, in a way, of the Cheshires as the 22nd unamalgamated. But morale was high. People were looking forward to it. We'd trained to be an armoured infantry battalion group at very short notice, from a short notice deployment in the November of 91 to Germany. We'd trained, morale was high, we'd done our conversion, and therefore it was good to put it into action. And it was seen as a change, if you like, from the normal deployment to somewhere like Northern Ireland, which is the sort of normal unaccompanied six-month tour that soldiers become accustomed to. So morale was high. It was slightly, I gather, knocked by, while I was away, of course, by the extended nature of the notice period. We were actually set to go, or rather we were warned off to go in the end of August 92. We didn't deploy until the first week in November. And we'd been on very high state of readiness, and as anybody could appreciate, a high state of readiness for an extended period is not a good thing. And it also increased the length of separation as well to effectively 9 or 10 months.
So you get the knock-on effect of family problems developing.
Yes, we already had some, it has to be said, some families' problems developing before deployment, never mind during or after.
Yeah. Tell me about your flight to Bosnia. I mean, where do you actually fly into, and how did you fly there?
Mine was a bit of a, it was, let's say, to use the Cheshire expression, cake and arse party, frankly. The in and out, sort of toing and froing of various aircraft, and mainly American for the supply of kit, was fairly disorganised. Not disorganised, but it wasn't quite set in concrete by the stage that we were at in November. And the battalion was flown out by American aircraft, C-130s. And by the time I came to fly out, about a week later, we turned up with a couple of other soldiers who had been on courses, and we turned up to be turned back three times from Gütersloh, to be told, no, you can't get on. And actually, the thing that most sticks in my mind is one aircraft we couldn't board simply because it was full of snow chains for vehicles. They could you believe they'd actually forgotten in a, you know, Balkan mountain winter? A large amount of snow chains had been forgotten, mainly for B vehicles, wheeled, and light skin, soft skin vehicles. So we didn't get on a couple of planes, but no problem, you know, we knew we'd get there in the end. And I remember eventually flying down to, I can't remember the name of the port or the name of the airfield in Italy, mm-hmm. on the Italian coast, on the Adriatic, and then hopping across to Split on a C-130. Mm-hmm. And it was myself and the two soldiers from the battalion and Larry Hollingworth. And ironically, I learned more from him by picking his brains, having seen his face on television, about the current situation than I had because of my absence from the training of being on my RSO's course. Mm. So that was quite an interesting flight. And then it was a case of a long, protracted drive up through the mountains with a logistic convoy up to Vitez. So in a way, my deployment was quite nicely staged. I had a chance to accustom myself to what was going on, and it was phased almost, you know, it was, I sort of got into it slowly.
And you had a seminar with Hollingworth as well.
On the way through. Which helped.
And you found that quite useful?
Yes, I mean, obviously the guy's very, very deeply involved and entrenched in what's going on, or was then, probably still is, but he was quite, you know, he realised how little I knew, apart from the basics, and so he was able to sort of talk at my level and just give me a feel for what was going on. I'd obviously seen news reels and things, and so I realised some of it. But
had you visited Yugoslavia before?
No.
So arriving in Split was your first time in Yugoslavia?
Absolutely, yes.
And you stayed overnight in Split, or did you?
Yes, on the, is it the Galahad? Mm-hmm. One of the ships that was in the Falklands, anyway, one of the container ships. And so I stayed overnight there, very pleasant little cabin. Mm-hmm. And it almost seemed like it could have been anywhere, sort of a coastal resort in any part of Europe. It was pleasantly warm still, down at the coastal level, and very relaxed.
And then the following day, you drive up from Split into the mountains, towards Vitez.
Yes.
Was there a point at which you realised you were driving into a war zone? Right.
Yes. I can't remember the name of the lake now, but it's not far from Prozor. When the convoy pulled over, and the female convoy commander, Captain Melissa Dean, in fact, who's a loggie, mm-hmm. Royal Logistic Corps, said, "Right, chaps, let's get the body armour on, and these weapons loaded up, and helmets on from here on in." I had neither helmet nor flak jacket, but without being arrogant, I wasn't at all bothered by that. Mm. And that's where the Northern Ireland training came in, because I have memories of days in South Armagh and Cross Maglen when, frankly, we just, in the heat of the day, threw our flak jackets aside because they were just too hot and cumbersome. And so I'd never had much faith in them, although I later had cause to have faith in the helmet. We had a couple of people whose helmet saved their lives, literally, the ballistic protection they afforded. But that was the first realisation that people were taking this seriously. This was a shooting war, albeit we weren't actually doing the shooting most of the time.
Your convoy was soft-skinned vehicles.
Oh, yes, Land Rovers and drop vehicles.
How long did the trip from Split to Vitez take? Was it
8 or 9 hours.
Is it? And so you pulled into Vitez. Anything along the way that you could remember?
The main thing was the fact that I had it explained that they tried to institute a system of routes whereby the people were supposed to, the locals, the indigenous population, were supposed to come down from the mountain plateau on one route. And they tried to sort of broadcast this and get them to do it so that the convoys could go up one way, and it was almost a one-way system. But of course this didn't quite work, and a couple of times on the route we were stopped in quite horrendous snarl-ups, because of course the roads aren't anywhere near the standard of our, I mean, their sort of good, what they would consider a good quality A road is the quality of our smallest B country road. And also the decline in the quality of the roads was quite marked. I mean, when we got past Thomas Lovegrad, suddenly you went on to a basically hardcore at best, and at worst shale and mud. Despite the efforts of the engineers, of course they improved the roads drastically while we were there, but they were still basically tracks above Thomas Lovegrad and into central Bosnia. And so that's one of my abiding memories of bouncing around in the back of the Land Rover as we went up country, and getting worse and worse.
Had some sort of communications net been put into position by the time you got there? Presumably there were.
Yes.
So radio net had been established.
Yes. Communications had been established. Mainly, the guaranteed communications were satellite, provided by the Royal Signals. And it was quite interesting for me because they'd used VSAT for the first time.
What is that exactly?
I beg your pardon. It's yes. VSC-501. It's a large satellite system that can handle several subsystems through a series of modems and a sort of exchange system called a Euromux.
And does this provide secure instantaneous communication with England, presumably?
Yes, and both secure and instantaneous real-time comms. Right. It supported also a communications information system known as Mapper, which was a sort of offline. You typed messages in to a computer system and transmitted them, and almost had a sort of written conversation with somebody. But you could also send formatted data and things.
Right.
But comms had been set up, but because of the mountainous terrain and the fairly large distances involved, it was HF, and mostly Skywave HF, which of course is where I came in. Although, as I say, comms had already been set up, it was up to me to maintain them. And in the winter, when the ionosphere is at its thinnest, especially at night when it's cold, Skywave goes down, and you get virtually nothing as the the waves literally go straight through the ionosphere off into space. And so the guaranteed communications were the satellite communications. I had to learn very quickly about satellite. I'd learned a little bit on the RSO's course, but only an introduction, because an RSO is really primarily concerned with battalion level communications. I think in the future that will be one of the lessons, that satellite communications is becoming more of a thing.
Now, if I understand this correctly, if you wanted to communicate with, say, Split, you'd have to actually send it via, presumably, London, would you? With a satellite?
Yes, it was. It's amazing how things go from your mind. But yes, that was right. On Mentor, the phone system, the secure telephone system, which was a subsystem of the satellite, comms went, that's right, even to Split, were via London, up to the satellite, down to London, back up to the satellite, down to Split. You know, 2,000 miles for the sake of 200, really.
But you were nevertheless getting instantaneous communications.
Absolutely.
With this sort of system. But in effect, units at night would be isolated, because of the collapse of
Well, that's where that's where the guaranteed communications came in of the 501 system. But also we had Inmarsat, which is a much lower level system. The media use, for example, uh-huh. It's a suitcase system,
uh-huh.
much less capable, but still gave you guaranteed comms at all hours.
Right. Inmarsat uses the same satellite systems, the same form of communication, going up to the satellites and then being beamed down.
Yes,
to London.
Yes, basically.
So. I'm quite ignorant of these things, and we've just been dropped, but I won't turn it off. We'll actually continue at this point. We can edit it out later on. What I'd like to ask you now is, I'm going to jump ahead slightly. What we saw with the Cheshires, on television and so on, was what appeared to be an enormous amount of media attention. Yourself, fall under the spell of the media? I mean, did they come and talk to you?
No, I was never interviewed. I was the appointment I held was fairly uninteresting to them. I was not in the thick of the action. Mostly, I was in the ops room, running it on behalf of the ops officer, running the communications. I got out quite a lot, but nowhere near as much as the rifle platoons. Soldiers, and therefore I was of very little interest, quite understandably. The only reason I got involved was I stood in as adjutant a couple of times, and thereby I was looking after the commanding officer, who was obviously in the media eye. But also we operated a very open officers' mess, which included all the officers of the battalion group, some 60 officers, and the press were invited in on the sort of unwritten understanding that they didn't publish anything of a flagrant nature outside, but that was breached once or twice in a minor way. But I mean, I met all the main players, if you like, Kate Adie and Martin Bell and people like that, and they were very down to earth, very straightforward and normal, and they weren't just interested in the main sort of players on our side. They were just part of daily life, if you like, when things were going on.
This is fascinating because were you given any training at all at how to deal with the media?
Not specifically for Op Grapple, but you get a little bit on various courses as an officer, as you probably know. But no, nothing for Op Grapple, and I didn't need it in the end anyway.
But obviously there were officers who did, and indeed one could argue that Colonel Stewart actually evolved a new form of warfare where he used the media as a major weapon.
Yes.
The way that it's never been used before.
I mean, to say that I didn't have any... Oh. I mean, obviously a lot of the officers did, especially we had... we always have a unit press officer anyway. Colonel Stewart was obviously trained, and his background and experience obviously was... Of most value. I mean, it could have had something to do with the selection of the battalion group. Even he had a degree in international politics. He had been an MA to a NATO council general as a lieutenant colonel in one of his previous jobs, and was well aware. And it became quite obvious as well aware of the power of the media and manipulation of it, frankly. Albeit that's probably a two-way thing. I mean, their manipulation of him as well. But other officers were trained in handling the media.
But your general impression when you're having the open mess and you've got these newsmen around you is that you could actually speak to them freely and openly on the understanding that anything they picked up in this way they would not use.
That's right. Generally, that's not a problem with the what you might call the higher grade, the ones who've made it, who have nothing to prove, the likes of the Kate's and Martin Bells and Robert Foxes. The slightly less well-known, who perhaps still have to make it, you have to be a little more wary of. And that quite often came down to personal matters, if you like, discussing personal attitudes to it. You have to be a little careful, but... just a bit of circumspection, no great sort of secrecy or anything.
Did you have dealings with foreign newsmen there, like the Australians, Canadians, Americans?
Yes, they were around, certainly. Americans, NBC, that kind of thing. But I didn't have personally have any dealings with them.
Could you tell us a little about your movements around the country? You obviously moved around, so on Bosnia.
Yes, I very early on decided to get out if I could. I was obviously tied to the option quite a lot. I went up to Kladan, which is on the way to Tuzla, in the northern Tuzla finger, which was where the medium recce squadron, 9th, 12th Lancers, B squadron, had set up in a disused abattoir, and were trying to force a route through to Tuzla, one of the largest towns in central Bosnia. I think the second largest, in fact, after Sarajevo. So Kladan was quite interesting. I was glad I got up there early, because that then was closed down as they moved northwards to Tuzla. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see the strip of road between Kladan and Tuzla, known as Bomb Alley, and to listen, in fact, on one particular occasion to a friend of mine, Monty Woolley, of the 9th, 12th, being mortared on that strip of road. I had to visit later on Tuzla on a couple of occasions to issue crypto and see my outlying signals detachments up there. I also visited Gornji Vuku for the same reasons, and also on occasion just with the commanding officer as a communications advisor in his warrior. I also visited Sarajevo. We did a recce about halfway through the tour. There had been a proposal that the Cheshires might take over some of the duties in Sarajevo with warrior. We found it actually wasn't practical. The vehicles were too large for the street, too vulnerable, and therefore we didn't. But it was interesting to see Sarajevo. Abiding memories of stopping at traffic lights on intersections of roads, waiting, not because of the red lights or green lights, which mostly weren't working anyway, but because of a firefight going up on the next block and having to sort of just pause and wait until it had finished or died down till you could get across, and of the bizarre sight of shells, you know, landing on sort of suburbs only a matter of a few hundred metres away, the odd sniper shot, and just generally the awareness of keeping one's head down, especially going up Sniper Alley, and the difficulty we had getting out that night as well. This was just shortly after the Bosnian vice president had been murdered by a Serb soldier when he was under protection of the French battalion on the airfield, and so they were fairly touchy and suspected us of trying to smuggle Muslims out in the back of the warriors. A T-55 rolled out onto the road just by the first Serb checkpoint on the way out, and effectively the door was closed on us because behind us the airfield had erupted into a firefight again, and we were stuck in this rather nasty situation with lots of cocking of weapons, and eventually Major Alan Abraham, who was commanding the 9th 12th Lancers squadron, who was with us, basically with a mixture of pomposity and his extreme height at about 6'6", managed to over talk, if you like, the Serb commander of the checkpoint and say, "Look, my friend, you're not going to get us to open up all the warriors if you've got soldiers that are armed nearby, so we'll disarm." And the two of them took off their weapons and their accoutrements and went round, and we were out of the tops, the mortar hatches of the warriors anyway, bearing in mind I wasn't commanding a vehicle this time. And so they opened the doors while we were able to watch the doors being opened from the top, and of course they were both unarmed, and that was the only compromise we could come to. It was actually, strictly speaking, against the UN policy, and certainly against our policy as British soldiers, to allow anybody to inspect on demand our vehicles, but
flexibility
and a bit of compromise, you know. And it won the day.
How many warriors did you have in that convoy?
I believe it was about 4 or 5.
With any light tanks at all?
No. Beg your pardon, they were, well, in terms of light tanks, they were two scimitar from the medium recce squadron.
So I keep calling them light tanks. So this is a very dicey situation indeed. Was it the most dangerous situation you were in Bosnia?
No, I think the most dangerous was as part of battle group headquarters, the adjutant and myself decided to exercise, if you like, battle group headquarters and the crews of the vehicles, it normally moves as an entity in war 2 to 5 k's behind the main lead elements. But what we decided to do was take out the command vehicle commanded by the adjutant, my vehicle, which is normally the recce element of the battlegroup headquarters, a recovery vehicle, and the regimental medical officer's vehicle, and I think the INT wagon as well, the intelligence vehicle. And we decided to just get the vehicles out, and get the troops out, and to sort of give a purpose to it, we took some food and supplies to a very isolated village in the mountains, or rather we attempted to. Upon turning off the main road at a place called Busavacha, which was the centre of much Croat and Muslim fighting, we came upon a roadblock. We didn't realise at the time this roadblock was to protect a Muslim headquarters a little way up the road, and that most of the soldiers manning it had been turned out of their homes in the nearby village of Busavacha by Croats. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we couldn't be turned back, or rather, we had to come to some form of compromise, but we weren't just about to turn tail and flee away. But mines were on the road in front of us, RPG-7s were pointed at us from all directions, and it turned a little bit hostile. The adjutant wasn't prepared to be flexible in terms of he wanted to bring warriors down to actually force the passage through, which was understandable. But on the other hand, we can understand them not wanting us to go through. Very difficult situation. As we were talking, we were in a T-junction, a shallow T-junction off the main road, just near Busavacha. And the curious thing was a truck went past, and it was a truck mounted with a Dushka 12.7mm machine gun. Mm-hmm. And five Croats in very recognisable Croat uniform, probably HV, the more extreme element of the HVO, manning this thing, and with balaclavas over their heads. And it's funny how these things happen. In Northern Ireland, all the indicators would have been there before that had happened, and I would have been on edge anyway. But it was such an everyday sight to see these armoured trucks, admittedly not with soldiers or the weapon mounted on the back, but at this stage it just sort of happened in slow motion before my eyes as they drove past. And within seconds, all the Muslims on the roadblock had opened up, with us in the middle. Two mortar rounds impacted on the roof of the house about 50 yards away. RPG-7s were fired into the two cars at the roadblock, about 100 metres further up the main road from us. Obviously the occupants, probably innocent, just didn't emerge. My abiding memory is, just before I managed to scuttle down inside my cupola, was seeing a larder or some such cheap eastern car with smoke billowing from every orifice of it. An absolutely horrendous sight. RPG-7 had just impacted into the side of it, probably for no readily apparent reason other than just firing at the nearest thing moving. I didn't actually see what the Dushka was doing, but I gather it was just an armoured chute mounted from Busavacha by the Croats against the Muslim checkpoint that they reckon was illegal on the main road further up from us. The basic point of the story is we were caught in the crossfire, and it was quite nasty. I actually shut my interpreter out of my Spartan totally by mistake. As we dashed back from talking to the Muslim in charge on the checkpoint, she went round one way, Susanna Hubija, I think her name was. Mm-hmm. She went round one way and I went round the other, and I was convinced that she'd got into the vehicle before me.
Right.
And of course, going from the light to the dark of the interior of the vehicle, my immediate reaction was to slam the door, mm-hmm. And look around, and the next thing I heard was a knock, and obviously you can't make much of a knocking on the door of an armoured vehicle, and this plaintive voice, let me in, but much to her credit, and very typical of the bravery of our locally recruited interpreters, she was not panic-stricken, despite bullets flying very, very close to where she was standing and all overhead. And I immediately opened the door and dragged her inside and slammed the door again. And I also remember climbing out to the top of the cupola, despite the crossfire, to retrieve my camera, which I'd left on the deck. And such is the stupidity of risking your life for just a very cheap camera. But that was a near thing. We extracted by reversing very quickly back out onto the main road and scuttling off back towards Vitez to make a report of the situation, which actually deteriorated then over the next couple of days into quite general fighting around that area. But it was